Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the Flesh and Blood and Bone podcast. And happy Halloween. Welcome to our freaky filmmaking episode where my dad, special effects makeup artist Tony Gardner, and I sit down with two amazing guests, director Chris Landon and writer Michael Kennedy. You might be familiar with their work if you've seen movies such as Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse, Happy Death Day, Freaky, of course, It's a Wonderful Knife, and most recently, The Drop. I'm so excited for you guys to get into today's episode. If you're a filmmaker, you'll deeply resonate with what Chris shares today. Originally starting in found footage horror with things like Paranormal Activity, and then diving into his first quote-unquote true narrative feature with Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse. Because I started in horror documentaries, I really resonated with what Chris shared about diving into his first big feature. And if you're listening to this and think you're on the opposite side of the film spectrum and want to be on the other side in a different genre, you think the grass is greener somewhere else, you're going to want to listen to what Chris shares because you'll most likely resonate with it too. And today, Chris and Michael remind us that we need to live our lives because that's where creative serendipity does happen. There's a death scene in Freaky that's inspired by Michael's upbringing, what Chris noticed in the surrounding areas of where they were filming, as well as what probably the two of them thought was a sign from the universe of two crew members who are partaking in an activity that they put into the movie. And if you're writing a script where it's maybe hard to suspend disbelief, not only for your audience, but for yourself, you're going to want to listen to what Chris and Michael have to share because they share a quote that you are going to want to save in your pocket, and it is going to get you out of your head and stop spinning in circles. I do apologize, everybody, for the drop in audio quality for the last 30 minutes of the episode. We were having technical difficulties when filming. Maybe the building was haunted, but I appreciate you all bearing with me as I get my footing in the podcast realm. I included it because the last bit of the podcast gets very personal, and Chris and Michael both have brilliant and amazing things to share. I didn't mean to draw the conversation towards myself, but I've had a really difficult time getting through my first big narrative feature, and what they shared was exactly what I needed to hear and very motivational. And to have the privilege that I do to be in the room with the two of them and be listening to that, I wanted to include some of it for you guys as well, so that hopefully if it's something you need to hear to keep going, to be inspired or motivated, that it reaches you too. So enjoy our episode on freaky filmmaking. Thank you for being here.
Hi.
Just insert laugh track. Da, 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 da. Yes. How are you guys doing?
Good.
Yes.
Yeah. Very good.
I've been so wanting to do an episode on Freaky because it came out over COVID, as you remember. And I feel like it didn't... What? I feel like it didn't get enough flowers that it deserves. At the time, so now we can talk about it.
Okay.
Yeah,
we agree.
I agree with that.
Yes. Yeah. You guys have worked together on several projects now. Most recently is Hard Eyes. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, correct. Okay. Yes.
Which was amazing.
Super fun.
And since then, you've done The Drop, which was also very amazing.
Thank you.
Now I saw on your IMDb is Happy Death Day to Us.
We hope.
Really?
Question mark.
We hope.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
How about a crossover?
Oh.
Happy Death Day.
We've heard of that one too. But
all those blonde leads together and
that's it.
Form a club.
It's my Hitchcock era.
It's great.
Yeah.
What did I text you one day? Totally freaky killer? No.
Totally freaky. We're just trying to combine as many
happy, totally freaky
movies
death
as possible.
Pre-existing.
Freaky
yeah. Totally freaky death
day eyes.
Yeah.
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 We'll see.
Well, funnily, Totally Freaky Death Day is all Blumhouse.
Wow.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It's possible. We can get all the blondes.
That would be amazing.
Together. Yeah.
We'll see.
My first question is how it came about to be. I know you originally had the script idea that you took to Chris.
Yeah.
Am I incorrect in saying? Okay.
It's funny because it originates weirdly through him, but I didn't know him.
That's fair.
I was watching Happy Death Day. I was rewatching Happy Death Day one day, and it was like soon after my dad died. And that movie is really emotional. Like a lot of Chris's movies are surprisingly emotional, I think, to people when they see a Chris Landon movie for the first time. But there's a theme of death in that film, weirdly. And there was a lot of I just remember Tree just having like a, I don't know, there's just a moment in that movie that really got me right after my dad died. And I found myself like literally bawling my eyes out while watching this scene. Wow. And I knew of Chris and knew of his story and about his dad and stuff like that. And I had remember thinking like, I wonder if he's like channeling some of his own like grief here. Cause I was like kind of mired in grief at the time. So I was like, I should do the same thing. I should try to find a, like a way to channel this, this grief I had. Cause I have like a complicated, like a good relationship with my dad, but also complicated. A lot of left stuff left unsaid when he died and stuff. So I was just trying to channel that. And then my immediate thought after that was like, okay, cool. So how do I rip off Happy Death Day? Like, and literally Googled like 100 greatest comedies of all time. And like, just went through a list of comedies and was like, oh, Freaky Friday could be fun. And then I was like convinced that it had already been made.
Oh,
so
really?
I Googled that forever and ever. And then didn't find any evidence that a body swap slasher had been made. And then I kind of just woke up that night in the middle of the night and kind of had like an epiphany of like what the basic story would be about a girl swapping body with a guy. And I like immediately thought of the doula. And so like I have an email to myself like that day.
Oh, that's cool.
At like 2 a.m.
that's
just
really
so I didn't
cool.
forget.
Yeah.
And then Chris and I met after that. He did my podcast at the time and we became buddies. And then one day I was having lunch with him and was like, oh, I'm getting ready to pitch this movie to Ryan Turk on Thursday. And he's like, what is it? And I was like, oh, it's like a body swap slasher. And he offered to help me get the pitch ready.
Okay.
And so the very next day, this man comes to my fucking 9-to-5 job at Family Guy, sits in my freaking office with me. And I don't know if I've ever told you this, but I was so happy when you go, I don't want to hear your pitch. We're friends. That's weird. Let me just read your pages. And I was like, thank God. I don't have to pitch this to him. So he just started reading my pages and I could hear him laughing. And
oh, that's great.
He started doing his Chris things that I now know are Chris things, like picking his nails. And then he was pacing and started pitching all this amazing shit. And I just took a shot and said, do you want to do this with me? And he goes, yeah, actually I do. And I was like, holy shit.
So I'll preface this by saying, like, I have never written a movie with someone else before.
Ever. Oh, wow. Oh, before that point in time?
Yeah, never. I was always a one-man band. I never worked with anyone. I wrote on one TV show for one season, and that was enough. No,
same.
I'm kidding. Actually,
like,
they were amazing.
Enough.
I actually had a they were it was
great
a fun
show.
But yeah, so it was a like step out of my comfort zone. Like, this will be interesting, kind of a,
yeah.
of a moment. But I was so. When I read the pages and even just the pitch, like the one liner, like
first line on the top of it,
I was like, how the fuck has this not existed yet? You know,
yeah.
It was one of those moments. And I had a similar moment, like when I came up with the idea for Disturbia, it was like, why hasn't this been done yet?
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, wait, it has Rear Window. But yeah, I just was like, I just knew that being able to sort of like unpack all of these tropes and still do something that was really character forward was really appealing to me.
That's the important thing. You could have all the guts and gore, but if we don't care about the characters, then what's the point? I mean, you know what? There's a lot of movies like that, though. So
there's some that are just
some are
so fun.
And they're disposable.
Yeah.
And,
and that's the
but
point.
You know,
that's
the
point.
Like
most
of the time you go, I'm not knocking it, but like most of the time you do go see like a Saw. Not necessarily for like the complex characters, but like to watch people die horribly.
Get their head
and it's so deeply satisfying.
Although then when your friend hosts a Saw marathon and you watch all 10 Saws in a day, you have to question your life choices.
How do you sit through 10 of them?
I didn't. He did. They did.
Who was it?
Zoran from Dead Meat. Yes.
That's so crazy.
Wow.
Guys, meth helps, you know? It's perfectly acceptable when you need it.
That's really cool. I just directed my first feature film. So that was my first time writing with somebody. And you never know if you're going to jive. And I think a lot of like, I don't know, in your opinion, but like having the same tastes in movies in general and then horror, I think is like ultimately the foundation if you're going to get along well.
I think it goes beyond that, though. I think you have to have a certain similar worldview.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have to have a certain similar sense of humor in our case.
Yeah.
And I also think, like, what he mentioned earlier is that we did have this sort of, like, foundational grief.
Yeah.
Something that both
it's part still, of Ricky as well, too.
Still authored yeah. so much of like yeah. everything. I'm like a fucking, it's like I'm writing Disney movies because like it's always about like my parents dying, you know? But it's true because, yeah, when you know, like we're, you know, orphans.
We're both orphans now. Yeah.
Yeah. So like when you lose your parents, and I lost my dad when I was 16, and it had a huge impact on my life. And so for me, because in lieu of traditional therapy,
right.
I decided to monetize my grief.
So smart.
I was like, I'm going to make money off being sad. And so I decided, yeah, that would be my therapy. And it has
and it's
ever since.
Super helpful. Freaky is a weird movie too, because like my dad's death started it, and then my mom died like 2 weeks before it came out. So like it's a bittersweet film.
Wow.
Sad thinking about it, but it's also like really fun.
Yeah.
Because like it wouldn't exist without those traumas and
right. And without
grief
them.
And, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's pretty cool. But I think Chris is right. Like we went in. It was funny because like I was like, do you want to do this with me? And he's like, yeah. And then I woke up the next day. I'll never forget this. I wake up, look at my phone, and I already have a text from him. And he's like, wake up, bitch. It's time to start working. It's like the first thing he texts me. And I was this is going to be so fun. But like, I honestly never imagined that we would be sitting here 6 years later.
Oh, yeah.
You know, on like.
Still talking about it.
Still talking about it, but also like friends and.
Yeah.
Like we were friends already. I think that was important to it too. Like we were friends first.
But you have a very solid relationship.
Yeah.
You know,
like we talk regularly outside of work and stuff. Yeah. Like,
aww.
Bitch just took me out to dinner for my birthday on Sunday.
Yeah. When was your birthday?
My birthday was in August.
It was
very delayed.
So I'm not that good of a friend.
No, he lives in Santa Barbara. It's a scheduling thing. And it was really wonderful. It was a wonderful dinner.
Mine was in September, so there's still time.
Of course.
November.
Guys, I don't mean to brag, but mine was last week, so.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Happy death day.
But yeah, like we went into it, and I'm just glad it worked, because it worked in a lot of ways. I remember him emailing me the day before the movie came out. And I don't know if you remember this, but you sent me a really sweet email being like, this whole thing is great, but the friendship is the thing I love the most about this project. And I was like, God damn, like, I'm really lucky.
Yeah.
You know, like you don't get that with everybody you work with.
Especially in this industry.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And it's, we've stuck together for 6 years now.
I think we both place a very, 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 very high premium on relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And the personal experience of the process.
Yeah.
Because you can't control the outcome. You can't, there's no guarantee that your movie is going to work.
Still
that it's
learning
gonna perform.
And he still has to remind me.
You know, like it happens all the time. And so for me, it's like, it's the journey.
Yeah.
Not the destination, which is so corny, but it's true.
It has to be.
No, because it's the art of compromise.
Otherwise you'll just be super bummed out and you might stop. Because it's hard.
It's so personal
and hard.
But whenever people ask me, like, what was your favorite part about Freaky? They always expect you to be like, oh, it came out, or like this part of the movie. And it's like, no, like making the movie was so fucking fun.
Yeah.
Like and I'm spoiled because that was my first project. You had Chris directing, runs an amazing set. You had Adam Hendricks producing, who's like, met him on set. He's just like, just such a fun guy.
Yeah.
You had the Andahar twins running fucking design, and you had you doing the mask and all this stuff. So you had all these wonderful people, and you're just like.
And your cast.
We had Vince Vaughn and Catherine Newton.
I still talk to Catherine. We got a picture last night from Celeste and Catherine. They ran into each other in New York City. And they're like hugging, and they're like, hey, freak fam, like, look what, you know, like.
That's great.
Celeste said something to the effect, like, thanks for bringing us together. And it's like, that's the kind of shit. Like, how cool is that?
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's also it spoils you because you expect every project to be like that way.
Yeah.
And it can definitely not be like that sometimes.
And they're not all like that, you know?
Yeah.
Minor.
That's true.
Don't mean to brag.
Totally. But like, that's when I knew Hard Eyes was going to be good. When I went to set on that, I went and visited for 2 weeks. And the first day I was on set for like maybe an hour. And I text my husband and then immediately text Chris. And I text them both being like, this is going to be a good movie. Aww. Because I could just tell, like, it had a very similar vibe.
Yeah.
Like, Josh is crazy energetic. So like the cast feeds off it. And then the cast, I just remember Mason, Olivia, and Gigi bonded the way I remember Catherine, Misha, and Celeste bonding. So like I walked in on set and I was just like, oh shit, these people really love being around each other.
Yeah, it's great.
And you could just see it being filmed. Yeah. You know, and I was like, oh, this is going to be a really good movie.
Yeah. And it was. And
it was. It was.
Still is.
Still is.
And I didn't go on set for.
I know. I'm a bum you weren't there.
But I met everybody. There were like back to back screenings for like 2 weeks.
Yeah. We went to the influencer screening, you guys.
And so many screenings.
So many
screenings. But there were, but like I became friends with the cast and I was never on set with them.
Aren't they the best? Like
they're just the nicest people.
Yeah.
Nice. Did you go to the Sony screening?
Yes.
The one we did at Sony?
Yeah.
Where it was like the cast, like it was like all their friends. Right at the Sony lot?
No, we went
to the one in Culver City, and then Josh and Olivia and Gigi. And then eventually, I think Mason, like, surprised everybody. That's funny. I went as Hard Eyes because nobody was, like, doing anything with the mask.
Oh, that's so fun.
They weren't doing any promo.
If I could just take the mask and dress up.
The best mask.
And they were going to do something like... Like how they had Ghostface walking around towns and with Scream, and they just didn't do it.
Oh yeah, there was a discussion.
They thought no one would know what it was.
That's textbook like stuff that happens. Like where you like all these things are presented, and then only half of them happen.
Yeah, they're like I remember asking someone. They're like, well, like Ghostface is everyone knows who Ghostface is. I was like, but that's kind of an advantage.
Yeah,
having a dude walk around a Hard Eyes mask. What is it?
I mean, that's the whole thing. That's the whole. It's like who is Darkman? Was the whole marketing campaign for Darkman?
Yeah, wasn't there that guy that walked around as a clown to promote his movie and. People were like, there's this killer clown around.
Is it for Terrifier, maybe?
No, it was like something much older. Katie's like, I know it.
Yeah.
Off to the side.
She's googling it. I gotta tell you.
No, you can tell
it was not Terrifier. Which one was
Gas.
It?
Oh, yes. And it was in England, right?
Wisconsin.
Wisconsin.
Which is like England.
It's a lot place.
Like,
it's England.
Same
it's
place.
England of the
exactly.
Midwest.
Yeah. We have Katie off to the side for those listening, and she also has a podcast with Fangoria called Katie Afraidy, so you should go check it out. Shameless plug. But back to Freaky. So that was your guys' kind of like coming together was Freaky. Mm-hmm. But you two, my dad and Chris, had met earlier on a film called Scout's Guide to the zombie apocalypse.
Just a terrible fucking title.
Well, the script title was Scouts versus Zombies.
Yeah. Scouts versus Zombies.
Who changed the title?
The studio.
Why?
Because they were like, we want to shove so many words into everyone's mouth.
We want no one to remember this title.
Yeah. They said the dyslexic.
If they ever do a marquee, they wanted to just kind of go.
The real answer that I got back in the day was that they had done like a focus group.
Of course.
They said they did a focus group and that the focus group decided that the title sounded like a bad bottom of the barrel Netflix movie, which maybe it did, but it was a lot easier to remember.
Yeah.
And it was more succinct and to the point.
Yeah.
And more fun.
Great title.
It was a great title in the end. Yeah. And that was what I thought was so fun. It was like these two things that have no business being together.
Right.
Together.
What's that movie about? Scouts and zombies?
Yes.
That's like the
literally
easiest sell.
Boy Scouts fighting zombies. Know.
Literally, that's like it. The easiest explainable.
Very, very,
very simple. Crazy.
Simple.
Plot. And that was the first time you guys had worked together?
Was it?
It was our first.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
What year was that?
2015 is when it came out.
Thank you. So
you're welcome.
More like 2014. Let's just call it.
So over 10 years at least.
Yeah.
So,
happy 10 year anniversary.
My longest relationship. No,
wait, how many movies have you guys? I'm going to interview them now. How many movies have you guys done together?
Scouts, Happy Death Day. Happy Death Day to you.
Uh-huh.
Freaky.
Hard Eyes. Yeah. And maybe Hard Eyes 2, Electric Boogaloo.
Hard Eyes 2.
You never know. I'm just putting it out there.
So wait, you said that Scouts versus Zombies, I'm still going to call it that because it's the only thing that
it's
makes sense.
It's better to call it that.
Yeah. That was your hardest film? Or something.
It was definitely the most like physically and mentally, I think, taxing.
There's a lot of stuff
experience
going on.
Of my
big scope.
Career. It was a big movie for what it was. I was admittedly still on the greener side as a director, and I had just come out of a long found footage.
Yes.
Sprint.
Oh, right.
That's right.
And I had made back-to-back found footage movies, and I acquired I wouldn't call them bad habits, but they were just habits that didn't fit sort of more traditional filmmaking. And so on one hand, I was really sort of adept and clever and crafty with like a lot of like improv and stuff like that. But when it came to sort of like a lot of the just general nuts and bolts of like, oh, I can shoot coverage again. I can do like, it's different, you know, there's going to be a score and things like that. So it just took some gear changing for me. But the movie, just from a logistics standpoint, it was, I think we shot the movie in the sort of greater LA area, which was, you'd think, great. But we, for some reason, like every location we picked, I picked, my fault, was on the edge of what they call like the zone, right? And so it was all nights. I think we shot 40 nights.
Oh, wow.
That's a long day.
It was a long one. Schedule. It was a long schedule. And so we would all go to work in bumper to bumper traffic for like sit in our cars for 2 hours to get to set. Then we'd shoot all night into the morning. And when the sun was coming up, we got back into our cars. We sat in bumper to bumper morning traffic to go home.
God.
And it got to the point where like I would repeatedly and open hand as hard as I could smack my own face to stay awake while I was driving myself home because I was gonna black out.
Yeah.
Because
it's weird how like if you're really cruising, you actually can stay more awake. It was being in traffic and that constant lull of it all that was really getting to us. And we did have like people who were like getting into car accidents on our crew. So they finally started offering like hotel rooms and stuff for people because it was so dangerous. But like it was just a lot, like a ton of extras.
Yeah.
Like so many moving parts, a lot of complicated gags, really complicated set pieces.
Big cast too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was like a lot of people and a lot of really fun people. Like I mean, I got to work with Cloris Leachman.
I was about to say.
Like, oh, that was the best.
Like that was the highlight of, one of the highlights of my career. Because she was so fucking crazy.
Yeah.
In all the best ways possible. Yes. She was so cool. My favorite story is I was waiting for her to arrive on set the first day. And her daughter would bring her to set. And I was standing outside with Logan Miller and we were talking. And he was in his like Boy Scout costume. And all of a sudden she pulls up. And she sees Logan and she rolls her window down and she leans out and she goes, I'm going to eat your ass. That's all she said to him. Like, first intro. It's because she does in the movie. Yeah. Like, she eats his ass.
She chomps his
If you haven't seen the movie, you should probably see the movie.
Yeah, it's not a
It's a super fun movie.
But it was a really fun movie. I tried to make an Amblin-y sort of Goonies type movie with a hard R.
Yeah.
With a lot
makes
of
sense.
It feels like that way, but it's still tense.
And a lot of TNA, which was also very awkward for me as a gay. Like, it was so funny. Like, there was so much tit in that movie. And I had to direct these women. Like, there was an opening, like, shower scene where, like, this girl was in the shower and, like, she's rubbing soap, lathering her breasts with soap. And I would have to be like, on walkie or on like megaphone, be like, can you shake them a little and like lather the left one a little more? And I would literally say like out loud to you, I'm like, I'm gay. I get no pleasure from this whatsoever. Just keep going.
Like, very clinical.
It was very,
I'm thinking of the audience.
Very, very strange.
Oh my very God. Strange. And then you guys killed a lot of people.
Oh yeah. You know? Killed a lot of people. Pulled some penises off.
Oh, that's right.
My favorite sequence in the whole movie.
I need to rewatch this.
The best sequence in the whole movie.
That guy. Oh my God.
Oh my God. Poor Ty Sheridan. Okay, I don't know if it's even something I can. Am I allowed to talk about that?
I don't know.
No, it's so much worse than that. So there's a scene in the movie where Ty Sheridan is trying to escape the second story of this house, and everyone else has jumped out of a window onto a trampoline and like jumped over a fence to escape this zombie horde. And Ty is the last one out, but like he gets grabbed and he spins around and he reaches out because he starts falling backwards and he grabs this old zombie man's dick.
Right.
And so he's hanging backwards, like hanging on to this old zombie dick. But the gentleman who, because I you know, handpicked all these sort of featured extras, if you will, I don't know, and pick this guy because he had this amazing face, like the perfect face. But he was like incontinent. Anyways, we didn't know this, but he was wearing a diaper and had shit himself.
Of course.
When we were shooting the scene and we could not he was on a rail. Everybody, it was so tight and designed that we could not move anyone or anything. And so Ty had to hang onto this penis in front of, and his face is like right there. And there was a fan on the other side of the guy just blowing poop. The smell of hot, hot poop in Ty's face for hours. And like Ty would just start to like gag sometimes.
Did he get pink eye?
He didn't get pink eye. But it was just a really, and I'm telling you, like, this movie, I don't mean to go off on a tangent, but I'm gonna go up. But there were so many cursed things that, and there were a lot of them were my doing, and I'm like, and I apologize to every human being who worked on this movie. I wrote a scene in the movie that's set at a waste treatment plant. Well, you could like make any kind of weird plant look like a waste treatment plant. But I shot
you
at a waste treatment plant, which if you've never been to one,
don't.
It is the worst experience of your fucking life.
Tell because when you drive by one.
It smells so bad and the wind would blow through set and everyone would just be like, and like dying. And then to make matters worse, I am deathly afraid of spiders.
Oh, no.
And the amount of spiders there is so shocking. Like when we drove up to it, there was like smoke coming out of the trees. And I was like, oh my God, the trees are on fire. What's going on? And it was bugs.
Oh man.
Plumes of bugs coming out of every tree on flies. And where there are flies, there are more spiders because it's like a buffet. So like you had to go to the porta potties to like pee and stuff.
No,
and
you don't.
Would go into the porta potty with a flashlight and there would just be tons of them.
Chris is
all over the ceiling, coming down like, oh! I'm like trying to pee and I'm trying to pee on them and
oh
like
my God.
Yeah.
There's pee everywhere. Like,
it was terrifying.
That's horrible.
Yeah.
I'm sorry I asked the question.
Sorry, you asked it. You asked it. It was a fucked up shoot. We had a really good time in some ways and a really bad time. Oh, one last thing, because everything in this movie was connected to body fluid and stuff coming out of human bodies. Our last sequence was shot in this very, very old hotel that had an indoor underground pool.
Right.
And we had our little video village in one area and then where we could kind of be close to the pool, et cetera. And one day we're sitting there and there were hundreds of extras that day. And all the extras had gone to the same trough urinal that was the floor above us. And the trough urinal became so full with pee that it cracked the floor and all the urine came through the ceiling into our village and literally came down on all of us and our bags. So we got literally
peed
golden
on.
Showered.
Oh my God.
Like piss flooding. Like, so anyways.
What a shoot.
It was a really fun time.
Wow.
Just a lot of shit and piss.
Just a lot of shit and piss, mm-hmm. Literally. Well,
it was a good start to a relationship. It was a very healthy start.
It really, I mean, it was all uphill from there.
trauma bonding. Truly, I feel like you maybe really went through the ringer on your first, like, really big narrative and, like, got all the piss and shit out of the way.
Out of the way.
And, like, getting it back to freaky.
Sorry. That was such a tangent.
Sorry, I don't really have a segue after you said everybody got pissed on.
It's pretty gross.
And freaky. Like, where in the process with you guys, like, did you ever, because I've had experiences with my dad where they like and brought him on earlier when they were writing the script to be like, what's possible to kill people in certain ways? Did you guys already have it set in mind of how you wanted to kill people in Freaky? Okay.
He has a weird knack, this ability to walk through an environment and pick out everything in that space that could kill someone and exactly how they could die and what the best angle.
Wow.
I'm doing it now.
This microphone.
Exactly. I
do.
No, but you just seem to have a knack for that.
It's fun.
He does. Yeah. I wrote the opening scene first. Like, I took the first pass at the opening scene of the movie. And I remember sending it to him. And he's like, this is good. But, bitch, we're going to kill people with, like, a tennis racket, a toilet seat. I'm like, because I was just, like, stabbing people.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Oh, no. And he's like, no, we're not doing that.
We got to get
interesting. He's like, these are all going to be crazy deaths. And he, like, listed, like, four or five, and they're all in the movie.
Amazing.
So that was, like, we didn't even have, I think we had 10 pages at that point.
Oh.
So, like, yeah, he, like, went in and took my pages and then was like, you know, crush the girl with the toilet seat. And,
I do miss, though,
we had from the original opening, remember that we had them fucking in a treehouse?
Oh, yeah.
And they were going to kill them. We were going to get killed at, like, the girl had, like, a treehouse in her big backyard, and there was going to be, like, a big death in there.
trying to figure out. Sometimes you just like you think of things that are very sort of germane to a setting, and like what would I find there? You know,
like a wine cellar,
like a wine cellar.
Like, yeah, rich people have
wine cellars.
I don't even know if a wine cellar was in like the opening at first. I'm trying to remember.
Really,
it's my favorite kill.
So good.
Probably ever.
It's a great. Oh, wow. It's a great tone setter.
It's gross and fun, and I remember some fun. Like one of the things that's great about when you start making something and you start location scouting is that, you know, you will make discoveries on the spot where you're like, oh wait, like that's a great thing to use. Like I remember the house that we filmed in.
Huge fucking house.
Giant house. Yeah, it looks very, very big house. And we were in Atlanta, and then like we were walking around and like, I can't remember. I think it was someone in our group that like accidentally found a fur closet.
Oh, right.
And I was like, a fur closet. And it wasn't actually a fur closet. It was like a weird secret door that went into like another
room, I think, and then into a bathroom.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like, it almost had no purpose except maybe to fuck with people. But I was like, that's so cool. Like she could hide in a fur closet. He wouldn't know where she went.
So you know where she hides in the opening?
She looks like she's being smart in the opening. Yeah. So it was like, so writing to like that kind of stuff is also really fun.
So that's something that the location provided for you.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
Or like, for example, which is a sad thing.
It is a sad thing. I know exactly what you're talking about.
But we had written the original, there's that great sequence in the movie where they go to that miniature golf, the mini golf place that's all black lit and kind of spooky. And we had originally, that was originally written in a bowling alley.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It was a bowling alley, but we had a very tragic incident occur on that set. We weren't there. It was the day before we were supposed to be there. So they were pre-lighting. But it was so scary and awful and upsetting. And also like, you know, it was just like, you know, clearly we're not going there.
It was a Thursday night we were shooting when this happened because we were supposed to shoot there Friday. And we were sitting in Village like a couple hours later. I remember you being like, we're not sending my fucking crew to that location. But I remember sitting in Village and Chris was... You found.
I did. I found it.
The
I like started
on his phone.
I found it on my phone. I was like, "This place looks fucking weird." I drove there on a weekend to look at
you
it.
You guys did like a scout. Like
we did like
hours
a quick scout, and I went, and it was like, it was actually a spooky mini golf place.
Oh shit! So that's
like a lot of that production design is real.
There's a lot of added stuff.
Of course,
they added
Twins
a lot,
did some great,
but additions. That was the template. Like
that's
that was
amazing.
The foundation.
Like the black light was part of
it. It was part of it.
Yeah. The black light
the black
was part
light
of it.
And the spooky. It was like a haunted.
It was a haunted mini golf.
That's great.
That's so perfect.
Yeah. But, so I was like, this is meant to be.
Yeah. Cause I think I think they just canceled the next day of shooting. And I think you guys went the next day.
Yeah. We canceled shooting.
Because we had to be there Monday.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Or Tuesday or something.
It was a quick turnaround.
It sucks that happened, but like.
It was awful that it happened.
Golf course.
But it was
cool better than I think anything that would happen. We had a cool thing at the bowling alley where Millie threw a bowling ball.
Oh.
Vince Vaughn would have thrown a bowling ball.
There were some fun gags.
There were some fun gags with bowling balls and pins and stuff. But the golf course ended up being...
It's great.
It's cool.
Yeah.
It's got more character.
Yeah. Definitely like stands out too as far as like a set piece. Because I was watching that. I was like, that's such a good idea. then it has black light and colors. Yeah. Like
it looked cool.
Yeah.
It looked really cool.
It's visually very fun.
Did you want to ask about the... cryo chamber?
Oh, yeah. So I had a question. Mm-hmm. So here's the thing.
Yes, it's possible.
Yes, it is possible. It is possible to have a cryo chamber in your school. It is. When you're writing something like that, and because it is a cool death as well as something to spice things up, especially at a school, because you already have Alan Ruck's death with a saw.
Yeah.
And I had woodworking class in my middle school and high school, so I was super excited to see it in a movie because not many people do.
Yeah.
And so it's like, what else do you do? That makes sense. But also, as an audience member, I'm like, would they have a cryo chamber? But when you're writing it, is there ever a point where you're like, fuck it. The movie's about a freaking dagger that switches people's bodies. So who cares?
So in fairness to us and the movie, the high school that we shot at in Atlanta had a spin class.
No way.
It's a brand new high school, too.
It had a fucking spin class, like a spin
amazing.
Studio.
Brand new school.
In it. And one of the other things that I started to research and poke around was that, you know, a lot of these, especially I would say like well-moneyed Southern schools are so deeply invested in their football programs.
Yep.
Yep.
That they provide
like cold ice baths,
cryo, I actually found these things in schools.
When anyone would give a shit online
and
about
listen,
that.
Most people would not know that because who the fuck's going to sit down and do that kind of wackadoo research?
Right.
But I did. Yeah. And so I'm not saying many, I'm saying a handful, but they do. Which is crazy.
I'm from Ohio, which is a football state.
You are from Ohio?
We're from the same city. We grew up in the same exact suburb. But anyone that is from Ohio knows of Massillon Washington High School and Canton McKinley High School. They're major football schools. In fact, there's a documentary about both of them that Netflix did. When people would say on the internet, like, cryo chamber at this high school, I'm like, first of all, there's a 17-year-old woman in that 51-year-old man's body. So, like, get over the cryo chamber. But also, like Chris said, like, in Ohio and Texas are probably the two biggest football states. Those things are fucking
They throw
everywhere.
Money and all kinds of crazy shit for their program. So anyways, it's a little bit of a, but it's also not. So
there's a fun story there too, because we had the Ryler. Her death was in that locker room. But I remember we had a placeholder in the script when Chris went down to shoot or went to prep. And we traded. Remember, we would talk constantly, like, what are we going to kill her with? We need to kill her with something cool.
Because it was going to be like a flag pole or something. Okay.
Javelin at some point. Like, we were trying to think of things in a locker room that you could kill her with coolly, essentially. The Anahar twins, every Sunday when the guys were in prep, they would go to fucking cryo chambers.
Yeah.
Cryo chamber place. He calls me one day and pitches the death. And I'm like, oh my God, this is brilliant.
But also, like, I was so, brilliant. I remember, like, in, it was Jason 10, right? Was it?
Yeah. The head smash.
That was one of my favorite kills of all time.
Amazing kill.
Like, when that girl gets her
liquid
grabbed
nitrogen.
By the back. Yeah. And she pushes her head into the liquid nitrogen and smashes her head on the counter. And
yeah,
I was like, oh my God, like, that's fucking great. Like, so it was a little bit of a love letter homage to that death too as well.
Yeah. And look, I'm not hating on the cryo chamber.
Oh, no, you're right to point it out.
To question it. But also it's like, I think like for me, sometimes when we were shooting my feature, we shot in Ohio though.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
Cool.
In freaking Butler, Ohio.
Okay. Near Dayton there.
There were some times where I would get so caught up on, like, what was real versus not. And I had a hard time of, like, suspension of disbelief for myself because the circumstances of the movie are not reality anyways.
Right.
So, like, it's interesting to hear about
you know what's interesting about it is that, like, you do have to, even when you're peddling in the sort of world of fantasy, it only works if you are still following a certain kind of list of rules and logic. Like, you can't just upend everything. You can't throw the book out, because then there is no investment, because the whole time the audience is taken out of the movie questioning that choice.
Right.
And so as a general rule, I think we try to stay pretty as close to reality as you can while also kind of doing this other stuff. And the cryo chamber, I think, is an example of, like, is it common? No. Is it possible?
Yes.
And so it's when something is just not fucking possible where you're like, come on, guys. Like, we all know this thing. Like, why are you presenting something? I could use a few examples, but I feel like it would be belittling.
Yeah,
but it's just one of those things that, like, you still have to try and, like, keep the shit real.
Yeah, and I feel like you two especially, like, know the rule book so well that you're like, you know how to break the rules when you do, if you are.
And that's also a tone thing too. You know what I mean? Like, there's a difference between, like, for example, you know, when I made Drop, like, Drop is a movie that is is infinitely more serious and more sort of grounded in reality. And so you don't have as much leeway and latitude there. Like, in a movie like Freaky, you can get away with
some
pretty ridiculous.
You can get away with Vince Vaughn making out with a little
exactly.
Boy, you
know? Booker
Strode. Teenager.
Yeah.
He's 18.
He's 18.
He's legal 18.
He's legal 18. Yeah. Okay. That's true. I was 17. I was a 17-year-old senior.
I was too.
Oh my gosh.
I think if you, like Chris said, if you, the emotional stakes are real, you can kind of do anything.
Yeah.
But you still got to ground it in some sort of reality.
Yeah. And have a good actor, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Catherine Newton's amazing.
I would always take
umbrage with people giving Alan Ruck's character a little bit of shit, being like, no teacher would do that. I'm like, bitch, I had that teacher, and that's why we fucking killed him. Because yes! Alan Ruck is literally based on a teacher I had in high school who, in front of my entire class, mind you, I went to an all-boys Catholic high school, asked me if I was light in the loafers in front of the entire class. So that motherfucker
mean-ass killed him.
He asked you that?
Yes, in front of my entire class. All boys. Just mean. Yeah, mean motherfucker.
There's some mean-ass teachers. And by like, the way, most people have had them.
Yeah.
Like, yes.
Yeah. That's he's crazy unbelievable. I'm like, is he? Like,
yeah.
You ever met a health teacher in high school?
Yeah.
Or the football coach?
Yeah.
95% of them are crazy.
My first screenwriting teacher stood in front of our whole class and on our first day and was going like this. And we were like, what is she doing? And so if you are only listening to this, it looks like I'm
flipping pancakes.
It looks like I'm flipping pancakes. And she goes, this is how you flip a hamburger. And this is what most of you will end up doing with your lives.
Holy shit.
Really?
Yeah.
That's so rude.
And she subscribed to this notion of like, she thought it was important for her to be sort of like the champion of hard truths, of like cold water on your head, because the business was hard. And so like when we had to pitch our first, like part of the class was pitching an idea, like pitching a movie. And she just destroyed you. Like multiple students cried. One girl ran out of the classroom crying.
Probably I was.
Woman she let you have it. And she really thought like she was giving you vital tools to survive in the industry. But it turned out she was just a fucking
mean
monster.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like, okay, sure. Holier all right.
There's some people that just are like that. Like my very first agent, I remember him telling me I had pitched him these two ideas. And he's like, neither of those will sell. Nobody wants that shit. So I dropped him. 6 months later, sold one. It was very. I wrote a pilot for the CW that year. Didn't get picked up, but I wrote a pilot. And then the second project was Freaky.
Really?
Told me, no one's going to want that. No
That's
one's going to want that. Yeah. And
That's
it was literally
Did you email him after the movie came? Eat shit.
I've never said anything to him, but I do. I swear to God, every time I have a movie come out, I think of him. And I go, I hope he's seen that.
Do you ever drive by his house?
I hope he's. I don't know where he lives. I'm always like, I hope he saw my name on that fucking poster.
He did.
Zach.
He did.
When he told me that about Freaky, Chris and I were writing it like less than 6 months later.
Wow.
Or we fantastic. Maybe it sold That's it to amazing. Blumhouse 6 months later or something. But
do you find that motivational though?
Oh, fuck yeah.
When people tell you you can't do it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I love getting that.
I do too. He told me I would never make it as a feature person, that I should stick with television.
Really?
And it was totally the opposite. Like, wow. I'm not a TV person. So I'm glad I didn't listen to him.
Now, TV's, you guys were in writers' rooms, right?
I was in one, yeah.
So it's like how many writers?
On my show, I was on a cartoon, on an adult animated show for Fox, and those staffs are big. I think on mine, there was 18 of us.
Oh, wow.
18?
That's a lot.
I think there were like 10 to 12.
How do you get anything done, though? With...
Well, it's like and again, I can't speak too much to the process since I only did one season, but it is, they will, you as a group, you sort of break, you know, the arc of the season together. Like you kind of all think tank it, and then you get assigned episodes to write. Individual episodes to write. So I had an episode and another writer an episode. And,
got it.
But it's really tricky because in this particular case, the pilot and the guy who wrote the show just had a very specific voice.
Oh.
And it was nearly impossible to be inside of his head and to figure out what it was that he actually wanted.
That's tough.
And so you kind of felt like you were just sort of doing busy work for no good reason.
Wow.
Very, very little of like anything that anyone wrote ever appeared
have to be.
In the actual show.
When you guys write together, do you pass back and forth?
Yeah.
Is it like you'll work on it and then you'll like...
That's a good question.
Leave
we,
it.
Yeah, we do. We have kind of...
We assign chunks.
Chunks. We start together.
Uh-huh.
So like... If we're out like in the outline phase, we do most of that face to face. Like we get like when we do work together at the same time, very rarely. Well, even now that you're in Santa Barbara, like we'll still get together.
We still meet in person. So we'll write
very rarely
in person. We outline together. Once that's done, and it's a very detailed outline. It's a scene to scene outline. It's not like, oh, we'll figure this out later. It's like everything is there.
Yeah, our outlines are so detailed that we can write the script faster than we outlined.
Yeah,
oh, really?
If that makes sense.
Very the outline takes longer.
Yeah.
But then we we'll like, yeah, we'll, I'll say, okay, you take this section and then I'll follow. I'm going to do this section. And then we both write them and then we swap them.
Yeah.
And then I go over his stuff and he goes over my stuff. And then
we know each other's strengths too. Right, so like, I always know like if it's going to be a really big sequence, especially since Chris is directing, 9 times out of 10, Chris will just say, I'm going to take that sequence. I'm going to do the first pass on that.
Got it.
Because we know each other's strengths, like of what scenes you should like. Chris is always really good about going, I'm going to take these three and why don't you do these two? Or you do that one because of this. Or I'll be like, can I take that? Like, and we'll even do that to commit. Can I have that scene?
Yeah, because sometimes there's, you feel a certain sort of affinity toward one scene or another for some reason.
Or characters. Right.
Yeah.
Like, and it's worked for us.
Yeah.
You know, what started, Freaky started as like kind of like, I don't know if we ever went into it saying this is a one and done, we'll never do this again together, but it kind of went in just being like, let's, it was almost like an experiment in a way.
Yeah.
And it just keeps going.
Yeah.
That's great.
Which is great. I love it. I love that I don't think a lot of writing teams have this where like, we know too usually like when a project comes across our desk or if we think of something that we're calling the other person.
Oh.
And going, this is an us one.
That's great.
Yeah, because we both this write is mine. Our own stuff and then we write stuff together.
Yeah. And I love that we have the freedom too. Like I've pitched some stuff that I think we should write together. And he goes, you know what? I think that's a you movie. I love the honesty of like, you know, like Hard Eyes is a great example where that was Chris coming to me with the project that they wanted him to do. But
I was like, this has our name written all
over it. Like, this is
our plan for it because it wasn't what it was. Like,
yeah.
When you first got it.
When we first got it.
Yeah.
And I was like, ooh, but like, this could be like full tilt, like rom-com, but keeps getting invaded by a slasher.
And like, I don't think a lot of people do this either. Like, he went to Spyglass and goes, I want to bring somebody in on this with me.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
You know, so like, that's great.
Yeah.
Because like you just, that's a huge trust.
And we had a lot of
fun. We had a ton of fucking so fun. And we knew, I knew writing that too. It was a lot like freaky in the writing process where I'm like, we're writing a really fucking banger of a movie.
I could feel that they were going to make it.
Yeah.
That's great.
I think we just knew like it was so much fun to write. Sometimes I do think that's like it doesn't always work out.
Yeah.
I've written plenty of scripts where I was super, super, super proud of the script, but there are too many other opinions and forces at play.
I mean, our action movie.
Yeah.
We had a great time.
That's not done yet. That's not done yet. That still exists. No,
we have an amazing action movie.
But I'll use an example. Like I wrote one of my favorite scripts I've ever written was for my Arachnophobia remake.
Oh, really?
It is still one of my favorites. I also have to remind myself that like this is a business. And when you are asking people to give you
the business of art.
Millions of dollars. Right. Millions of dollars. They become more uncomfortable with risk.
Right.
They're very risk averse. And when you start to kind of delve into stuff that feels like you might alienate a certain sort of segment of the audience, they obviously, you know, and understandably will sometimes either do an about face or panic and sometimes it's stuff that you can overcome. You know, sometimes people lock arms and like, you know what? We still love it and we're going to go for it. Regardless.
And we're going to take a swing.
And we're
going to
go for it and see what happens. And then other times they're like, no, this is just too...
It's too risky.
This is too risky, too scary, and we're not going to do it.
I think that's something that I liked about Freaky was, like, there was an openly gay friend. And, like, I had a gay friend. I have lots of gay friends, first of all. I had a gay friend in college who is exactly like Josh. So I was just like, this is amazing. And then there's also like such a bigger discussion. Well, first and foremost, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that as a very small, petite woman who gets told she can't do a lot of things in life and like people think that they can take advantage of somebody small, especially a woman, it was so awesome to see a story where Catherine Newton's character gets to find out what she can do in a body that small and like feel really empowered by the end. So that was really awesome to see. I felt like it was made for me in some ways. Mm. And like even in the woodshop scene with Alan Ruck's character, like she gets thrown off. The butcher in Millie's body gets thrown off and she's like, oh shit. But then you see her like wipe the blood off her nose and she's like, a challenge.
Yeah,
for
like
I'm usually this 6-foot man.
Exactly. It was this isn't coming as easy as I thought, but I still want it.
Exactly.
But also like the butcher had like such an amazing like realizing how a quote unquote
weakness.
Yes.
It became his strength.
Yeah. Right.
Being in like this little body, totally thinking, people thinking like, oh, harmless.
Yeah.
Right.
A really interesting thing about that.
Yeah.
A really interesting thing about that was that at a certain point in the, right before we were starting to film the movie, there were some people who said that they did not want the ending. Mm. They didn't like the final confrontation.
The mom and the Millie and her sister and her mom.
Oh, yeah, because I guess technically you could have cut it after she's at the ambulance and her and Booker finally kiss.
And then the kiss.
And they kiss. And that was the end of the movie. Literally they argued that was the end of the movie. And what we argued back was, no, she has to win in her body.
She has to win in her own body.
She can't win in his.
I love that.
That's not the arc.
Would literally be like,
it's an incomplete arc for her character. Yeah.
Is her winning inside herself.
Yeah.
Also, so we were like, do you really want an unnamed cop to be the person that killed the butcher?
Yeah.
Like, it's not even
Nyla. And it wasn't even just that it was Millie winning, but it was also like that the three of them
together.
Did it together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was also really important to us. You know?
And the mom completed, like none of them would have had a completed arc. Mom,
right.
Coral's arc never got completed then. Yeah. And then Charlene's arc never got completed then.
They just get dropped off to the side.
Yeah.
And then that fucking last line. Yeah. Imagine that last line not being the line of the movie. I am a fucking piece. Like,
oh, yeah.
But it was so fun because, like, it was one of those great moments. Not like you're, like, trying to, like, prove someone wrong or, like, I don't go into it with any sort of, like, baked in animosity.
Test screening,
like,
though.
But it was fun to go to have a test screening and to hear an audience react to the end.
Yeah, cheering.
Which is awesome. When you're like, okay, see, it works.
And then in the focus group, which is like 20 people, right? Some of the men, but all of the women, they asked them specifically about the ending and literally every female's hand went up. And like many of them were like, because I think he might have even, the guy who ran in the focus group was amazing. I think he might have even said, do you need the ending? Like, I think he might have like been asking around that note. And all the women were like, dumbass. Like,
they wanted her to win. That was the most terrifying test screening I've ever had, only because
it was also like day one of COVID.
It was COVID.
Oh, like,
it was right.
California
was
locked down the next day.
It was the day before we locked down. And so there was this palpable
the 12th, I think,
energy in the room of like, are we risking our lives going to a test screening? And so it was so tense and no one was masked. Like, no, we weren't there yet. That hadn't started. But everyone knew that it was almost
something
like
weird.
Everyone knew that there was this like tsunami coming.
Well, also that same day, Newsom had made when a state does this, but he had said no more than 200 people in a room.
Oh, right.
So like
we were right under that
400 seat theater.
We had 198
and like
people.
But also at the test screening, your target audience is like 18 to 24.
Yeah.
Right.
No parent was letting their 18-year-old kids. So like our test screen, they literally had to let everybody into the test screening because there wasn't people to pick and choose from.
We barely had enough.
So they barely had enough. And I'm gonna say this because it's been 6 years, but like our test scores were hilarious because it was women 18 to 24, men 18 to 24, and men 24 and above, or I forget how the numbers are, all were in the 80s and 90s. And then women over 35 gave us like a 29.
You're kidding.
And they were the biggest group. Which normally in a test screening they wouldn't be.
Right.
In that kind of test screening.
We still walked out with a really good score. We still walked out with a really good score.
Yeah. Like,
but, great. But
isn't it hilarious? And then
that's wild.
2 days later this whole state was shut down.
Yeah.
And that was sort of the full circle, like this sort of the bittersweet sort of end of the movie. You know what I mean? That we never got to.
You got it that far and then it.
We just never got to really, it never got its fair.
Full theater release.
Full theatrical. Because it would have, obviously, pre-COVID.
Would have been a huge hit.
It would have at least it would have been a really fun movie to go see in a theater with a crowd.
With people, just the first 5 minutes alone.
I can't speak to whether it would have 100% been a hit or not. I know that people would have had a really good time.
Yeah.
When we saw it at Beyond Fest programmed it.
Not that
part
long
of Beyond Fest, but it was part of a Chris Landon retrospective.
Yeah. Which made me feel really fucking old.
When Drop came out and it was the first time seeing it with
an audience
like fully done. It was so fucking fun.
It was great.
Yeah, he was just talking about that it was his first time to see it with people.
Yeah,
I actually left that screening like kind of bummed. honestly, because it went so well. Yeah. And I was like,
what could have been?
What could have been? I was like, walked out of that in the car, and Brian's like, wasn't that so fun? I was like, I'm so bummed. We would be making like Freaky 4 right now.
Yeah. Well, who knows? Like, I feel
like you could just remake it now.
Yeah. I wish Jason would give it some.
Well, Freaky Friday got it
sort of thing. Yeah. You know, he
decades later.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. But you guys, look, in time, you know.
You never know, guys. You never know.
Black Phone 2.
Black Phone 2 is coming out. We're all going to see that tonight.
See that in a couple hours. We're
recording this.
So it's like, you know, why not Freaky 2?
Maybe.
Well, because I was even watching it last night, and like when Millie's in the ambulance and she goes, oh, I just hope no one never gets a hold of that thing again. And she's talking about the knife. And I'm like, ooh, are we talking about a sequel, Buzzard? I mean, like potentially?
Not going to say anything, but we know where we would start.
Do you?
Yeah.
You can't say anything, can you? But Catherine Newton would be there.
Oh, she would.
The cool thing is like our ideas for any follow up, they don't, it doesn't require them to be like 19.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's great.
You know, like Catherine could be 35 or 60.
That's great.
Yeah.
When you
I'll
wrote
be dead
it,
when she's 60.
When you wrote it, did you have people in mind when you were writing?
We had Catherine in mind for sure.
Did we had Catherine. Yeah. We really had Catherine and Vince.
And Vince.
We really did.
Yeah. I remember him telling me, he's like, I want both. Be lucky if I get one. We're probably going to get neither.
Yeah. Because that's
how
it usually goes.
Yeah.
So to get your two first choices was a career first, and probably maybe it's already over now too. No, I'm kidding. But especially the butcher role was really tough, just because there aren't a lot of people out there who can who have the physical, the imposing physical stature of Vince, but also the unbelievable dexterity. Like, he can be menacing and scary as fuck. He can be absolutely hilarious, but he also is a deeply emotional person.
Aww.
And so, like,
yeah, he was.
He got, there were a couple takes in the dressing room scene where, like, he was overwhelmed with emotion, where I actually didn't use a lot of it because he just got so moved by some of it that I was like, okay, we're treading. Like, he was in the moment, which I thought was so beautiful, but it was treading into a tone that wasn't
for the movie.
Fitting. He was like that in the car sequence too.
He
had moments on set. I remember him in between takes asking you, like, you and Michael were talking about this, can you remind me of it again? Because we were talking about our sexualities with Vince a lot about that scene. And he really he took it fucking serious.
He's a hyper intelligent person.
Because you worked with him as well.
The thing I liked about his performance with that him and Chris worked out really well with it. I think if you put 100 actors in that role that aren't Vince, 99% of them would have played it like Rob Schneider in The Hot Chick.
Oh, campy.
Super campy and over the top. I'm a girl,
Jessica.
You know, and Vince played it so understated.
Yeah.
It's a really brilliant performance. Yeah.
You really follow him.
And one of my favorite things about the experience making that movie, because this is something that I think more people today should try to do. Like, Vince as a person, he's very bright. He has great ideas. I got some of my best notes from him when we were in the process of, when we were in pre-production. He had great script notes. But he's also a person that, like, he's different. Like, he's very conservative.
Mm-hmm.
He's
not shy.
And he's not shy about it. And he talks about his politics and stuff like that. But, like, one of my favorite things about making that movie was that we would all kind of, he never sits in a trailer.
He's always in Village.
He's always on set.
Yeah.
He's always on set. He's always ready. He's always there. And we would get into these sometimes heated conversations.
Philosophical, political conversations.
But never to a degree where you lost respect for the other person. Never to the degree where you were like, I'm walking away from this person.
Correct.
I hate you.
Yeah.
Like, and sometimes, I mean, did anyone change anyone's mind? Not really. But did you hear them out? And kind of process and listen to it and kind of think about it. And maybe sometimes you saw a different angle that you didn't see before. Sure. But I just like that, like, at the end of the day, despite our differences, politically speaking and in other areas, we all join forces creatively. Yeah. And made something really cool. And made something that we were all super proud of together.
And loved. Like the kids would come to set on their days off.
Right.
Yeah.
But and I feel like it's because something.
Because they loved yeah. each other and they liked Vince. Like Vince, like yeah. to his he credit too hysterical. With them.
He would sit in that director's chair just off to the side watching. And
there were days I would piss my pants laughing stuff. Because of him.
Just so nice.
But he had, you know, Celeste especially, I felt, and same with Misha, they both were pretty green.
Yeah.
As far as feature films went at the time. Now they're both like stars. But like, I remember Misha one day being like terrified of improv. And then by the end of the shoot, was like obsessed with it. Catherine too. Catherine's like, Vince is teaching me things I never
Vince was
knew
a great,
were possible.
He was a great teacher.
To do on set.
So he was like, a great mentor and
great
a great
father
teacher.
Figure like, in that sense.
But the bigger like angle that I'm getting at is that like, I also think as a country, we used to do that.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely a less.
We had like, our differences,
right. time.
But we still came together
yeah.
to get shit done.
Right, you can have a conversation,
and that's well, what and, this process was like. And I just was like, it really did resonate for me because things obviously only got worse after
I think
COVID.
What you said too, right. like there was some like heated discussions sometimes between yeah. takes, but like no yeah. one ever got mad.
No one disrespected the other person or judged them.
And I will say this: wow. I will say Vince didn't quite understand the nuances of sexuality as much. And I think it was just purely out of the fact of like being a straight white male yeah. over 40, quite frankly, right. Growing up in Chicago and living in LA most of his life. Like he didn't fully understand it, but there were times where like he would go, oh, I never thought of it that way about Shut certain up. Things. Like he may never like completely changed his mind or whatever, but like the thing I really loved about him, he wanted to know everything about you.
He did.
He wanted to know my life story. He wanted to know what my parents were like. He wanted to know what it was like growing up gay in an Irish Catholic family. And it was never like purely, and it was a true interest.
That's mm-hmm. cool.
The best you know actors I mean? Are curious.
Yes.
Yeah. The best actors really, are curious like, people. They're innately curious people.
And like, sure, people are mad at him 3 months later when he was shaking Trump's hand at the Super Bowl.
Oh, he did.
But sorry. Like, I remember turning to my husband at the time and going like, I don't know, man. That's just the guy he is.
Right.
He would shake any
president's
hand
because yeah. I know meeting him for 6 months, it was the office that he was shaking hands with, not the person so much. Like he respected the office. So if it was Obama, right. he would have done the same thing.
Right.
That's really important.
Pain in the ass though, too.
What?
Yeah.
Vince.
No, he was
so fun to work with.
He's really fun.
Crazy guy.
That's really interesting. Yeah.
But like,
how'd you end up with Alan Ruck?
Oh my God, luck.
He's so nice.
Luck.
Another Clevelander.
Is he?
Parma. Never went back. Graduated high school and kicked out of Cleveland and hasn't been brought back since.
That was kind of me. Yeah.
Yeah.
How did we end up? Alan was. He was.
Was that a Terry idea?
It was a Terry idea. It was also like, obviously, was a big fan of Succession. And then there was just something about the idea of Cameron from Ferris Bueller.
Right.
Growing up to be a fucking asshole of a teacher that I thought was really funny.
We had
a piece of casting. It was really funny. And like, yeah. Alan is none of the things he is on yeah. screen like that. Oh, like yeah. he's super kind.
So yeah. he was only there like 3 days, but it was so wonderful.
He was amazing.
With him, the nicest guy. I remember you and I had a conversation about it because some of the casting ideas for that character were so obvious.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
It was like anyone you know who seems like a dick in real life or plays a dick in everything they're in.
Right.
Yeah.
But like someone had suggested like Jane Lynch at one point.
Oh, really?
Which was funny.
But it was
like
Sue Sylvester.
So on the nose. Yes. It's like she's done
she
that.
She's
like,
doing
I know her. Again. She's amazing.
Yeah. yeah.
But she doesn't even want to do that.
Yeah. But I remember he got brought up in our conversation.
Yeah.
And we were like, oh, that's really interesting.
He was great. He was just like.
So unexpected.
Oh, he's such a dick.
He's amazing, though.
And he yeah. would, like, throw that fucking book down, and then you'd yell cut,
he loved
and he'd
it.
Be like, was that okay?
Yeah. Because he's so nice.
Hi, everybody. It's me here to remind you that this is where the audio in the podcast does drop into lower quality. I do apologize, but keep listening. You're going to want to hear what Chris and Michael have to share about their struggles, and it's so fascinating how Happy Death Day and Freaky came to be, despite all odds, and advice to keep going. And if you're having a hard time listening to this, be sure to check out our YouTube channel where you can listen with closed captions. Thank you.
We had so much fun with Alan though, because we got to work with him at the shop and yeah. do live casting, get to know him, and we really liked him.
Mm-hmm. And then
we And then, yeah, then we get to go saw him in half.
But you guys did that in one take? Or was that two?
We did two.
There were a couple of different versions, though, because there was the sawing in half that was the full body.
The full body one, I think, was the first take, because I remember the leg getting stuck on the table, and then you ended up using it.
Yeah.
It looked so cool.
Right. It looked more awkward.
Yeah.
More real.
It looked more real.
Yeah.
It just worked
out. Yeah. But then when we were in the gym, and the walls were black for the close-ups of the
saw,
the head going into the saw.
And that's right.
And it was the real blade
going.
The
actual blade, yeah.
And we're like, where's all the blood going? Because we couldn't see any spray. And then somebody turned on a room light.
Yeah.
And the whole room was fogged red because the blood was vaporizing.
Totally vaporized.
Off of the speed of the wheel.
Yeah.
Did we kill him? We killed him pretty early in the shoot, right?
It was our first real kill. It was our first main location.
But I remember that was my first set experience. I remember
being there
just being like, what the fuck is this? Like,
We're
being paid to do this right now. Like, I remember the first take, the blood just flew.
Flew
up into the ceiling
and
everyone started clapping. Yeah. And then you see, like, I remember I was taking video for my husband and I'm like, there's like just dying, being like filming and doing voiceover for him. Like, there's six dudes cleaning blood. That's their job right now.
But then they're also like, guys, can you believe we get paid to clean up blood?
We couldn't believe, like,
and then there were guys like, how the fuck are we going to get the blood off the ceiling?
And then there's like the
30 feet high
guys that have been around forever being like, how the fuck are we going to clean all this? How are we going to do this, like,
location
and editing? And
I learned a good trick. What was it, Dad? Shaving cream helps get blood off
shaving
of
cream.
Surfaces
of a miracle. It's a miracle.
Yes.
Wonder.
Yeah. Just fun fact.
Yeah.
And you had, what, 35 days?
On that movie? No.
Yeah.
I read that and I was like, no way.
No. We had 30 days. I think we ended up at
32.
Like, I had to beg, steal, and borrow for those extra days because we were never going to make it.
No.
We shot Happy Death Day in 25.
Really?
Which is crazy.
That's a really ambitious movie to shoot in 25.
Yeah, that's a lot. I think
Hardest at 35.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Which still seems like it's not like a lot, but it's not.
It's not. No, we had 22 so on mine, and I wanted to fucking die.
And another movie we had on It's a Wonderful Life.
How many?
18.
How did you do
Are
that?
Are you serious?
Oh, my God.
I don't know. Well, watch the movie.
And they're strong.
That's
a solid B.
It's so hard.
It was
so
either
hard.
21 days and no Justin Long, or it was like 18 days
and Justin Long. And you need
and
Justin
like,
Long.
Kidding. Part of the reason we got our money was by casting Justin Long. So it's almost, we didn't really have a choice.
No.
Justin.
No, it wasn't
him.
No,
his schedule.
Shutters.
Oh.
Like you need a name in this role.
Did they kind of leave you guys alone on Freaky? Like other
Very
than?
Very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Do you think
that's one of my favorite things about
that experience?
Blumhouse
in general. I would say, as an outsider looking in of the Blumhouse world, where one hopes, if they love horror, to make it someday.
Yeah.
How is that experience like with them as a production company and like in general?
I mean, I've been working with
keep going back, right?
Yeah,
yeah.
I've been working with them for a long, long time. I've done many, many, many movies with Jason. Obviously, we started with Paranormal.
By the way, Paranormal Activity 2 is one of my favorite movies ever. I saw it in the theater, and I was like in middle school at the time, and it rocked my world.
That's amazing.
Paranormal 3.
Yes, but I like the second one.
Paranormal 3 is the fan kill, right?
Yeah.
For the fan moment.
The fan cam.
Yeah, that's pretty
best.
That's pretty badass.
Best sequence.
So, I mean, it's a great creative environment because you are given autonomy for the most part. Like, there's noting and there's stuff that happens in prep. You know,
yeah,
where they and there's a lot of back and forth, you know, but at least they never force a bad thing down your throat. They never force you to do something you don't want to do. You have to fit it in the budget.
Yeah,
that's the challenge.
I remember seeing emails being like totally blown away, being like Cooper would send notes and at the bottom and you go, and as always, Christopher, because he always calls him Christopher. It's always Christopher, do what you wish. Or
yeah, take it or leave.
Take the ones that you like or whatever.
So it's nice, which is it's a very empowering thing. You're more inclined to actually do a note if you aren't being forced
and they had some
to do another, which is kind of a funny reverse psychology thing.
Yeah,
but it is like
it's great though.
Duck season, rabbit season.
They had some good notes on the movie, though.
They did. They had some good notes and some good ideas, and also like you know, you are in control of your shoot. They don't like hover over you and tell you what you're doing wrong. In fact, they look at dailies, they check stuff out.
Yeah.
Also, editorially speaking, you do have your director's cut like you're supposed to. But there isn't a lot of meddling after that either.
Wow, that's really cool.
So it's always been a really nice process because they do trust the filmmakers that they work with, I believe. And they're a company that was always down to you know, take a gamble.
Yeah.
And to go for something that maybe a lot of other people wouldn't.
Freaky was a freight train. Like, Chris and I started writing it in February or March. We sold it to Blumhouse in May. Chris was shooting in October.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
So, like, it was very, you know, I remember Cooper had no fucking clue who I was when this all went down. So he brought me in for lunch like a week or two later. First thing he goes, he goes, okay, who the fuck are you? What was that? And then the second thing he goes, you know this will never happen again. I go, yes, Chris has prepared me. Because it's like so...
Just the speed of it.
Just the speed of it.
Like, literally like, buying
because the deal that we made...
It's greenlit.
The deal that we made with them was because we could have taken the script to other buyers. And so to sort of make it work, they said, if you were putting a clock on this deal, like... We're offering you a green light now.
Yeah.
So if you let us do this, we'll make it right away. Okay. You'll start production on
tomorrow.
We sent the script on a Thursday, basically going. I weirdly had a podcast relationship with them at the time, so I knew Ryan Turek really well. Chris, of course, with Cooper and Jason. So we both were like, we both decided like they need to get first dibs. Like we need to give them a little bit of a. Cheat on this, and so we gave it to them Thursday going it's gonna go to everybody else Monday. We had an offer Friday night.
Friday night, Saturday. Yeah,
and then the movie was greenlit.
Yeah, that is never freaking happening. That's again, that's crazy.
Thursday night Cooper and Ryan read, I remember, because Turek was texting me being like, holy shit, where did this come from? And then Blom was texting him Friday because he was reading the script. And I remember you sending me a screen grab of him going, the kiss in all caps.
Yeah.
Because Booker and Millie's kiss.
He was losing it.
And then we had an official offer Friday. And then I went to a movie Saturday night. And when I came out of the movie, my deal had closed.
You're kidding.
But they're lean. I mean, like, that was the beauty of it, too. And it's a little bit different
like
now.
We had to close it. Like, it wasn't just accept our offer. We had to close it before Monday.
Yeah.
But then our kickoff meeting was Friday. The following Friday.
Yeah.
That's like...
So we were at the...
But Happy Death Day was like that, too. Happy Death Day was a very... Happy Death Day was unique because it was a project that had...
sat
forever.
Yeah.
It was a movie that I had started on as a writer only. I was hired to rewrite that movie forever ago. And then it just sat on a shelf for like 5 years, 6 years, because they never made it. They just didn't make it.
Was it Blum or was it a different place?
It was a different place. It was a whole different company that had come and gone. Like the company didn't even exist anymore. And I understand that they were about to like take the name and the concept and they're going to turn it into like a web series back when people made like a web series. Yeah.
So we're going to be millionaire makers.
And I was having lunch with the producer, Angela Mancuso. And she said, it's such a shame we never got to make, back then it was called Half to Death. She was like, it's such a shame we never got to make Half to Death. And I went, oh my God, I completely forgot. And so I like dug up the script and I sat there and I read it because I hadn't even read the script in so long, but I read the script and I was like, this is so fun. And so I sent it to Jason, just like, hey, I wrote this script and it's so good and it's such a bummer. Like, we never made it. What do you think? And he read it and then he called me back and he was like, greenlit.
You're kidding.
Oh, and that's, my God.
So, yeah. So sat dormant forever. Was greenlit in an instant.
That's crazy.
Instant.
Never give up, kids.
Yeah.
It's crazy what will come back.
It was crazy. So you can't give up on your work, even when you think it's
I'm dead. Still convinced our action movies.
Good. I think I needed to personally hear that.
It's true. It is true.
It's so hard.
By the way, I've been doing this for fucking ever. And I feel like I still hustle and struggle.
Have to.
As much as I did before. I don't feel like I've ever like reached a point where I'm like, I get to cruise now, or people just send me shit and I'm great. It always feels like a struggle. And it always feels like it's gonna either go away.
Well, and weirdly, it makes you feel like you gotta do more.
Sometimes.
Like you gotta create more than you did before.
Yeah. But it always feels like it's always about to implode or go away forever. My poor husband has to listen to me talk about how I'm never making another movie again and that I'm done.
I had that moment last week with mine.
All the time.
Oh, for real? Never going to write again. No one's ever going to buy anything.
All the time. But it's also like the thing that keeps you hungry and keeps you excited and keeps you going, I think, too. Because like, I don't know what I would do if I ever reached some point in my career where everybody was like, whatever you want.
From a personal standpoint, too, the failures are great.
Yeah.
Like, think about it. Like,
no, they're not.
In some ways. Like, first of all, if I had listened to my agent at the time.
True.
About Freaky. And just said, oh, he's right. Like, that's not a viable thing. I'm just going to throw it away.
Right.
But also, like, the show I was writing on, I was determined that was going to be my future. It was going to be writing on an animated series for Fox for 20 years because it was by one of the writers of Family Guy. And it was going to turn into Family Guy. And it was going to run for 30 years. So I was going to be set. And it was not the case. I actually really disliked the experience. Nothing against like Mark, who ran the show, bright guy. It just, TV wasn't me.
Right.
And I came out here for horror. And had that show got picked up for a second season, I never would have written my pilot for the CW. I never would have met Chris.
Wow.
I never would have done a podcast for Blumhouse. I wouldn't have had the time.
Right.
I never would have thought of Freaky. Like all these things, I can connect everything in my life career-wise to that fucking TV show getting canceled.
Wow.
That's
Sure, maybe it would have lasted 20 years and I would have been a success working on a TV show for 20 years, but I often go, probably wouldn't have been happy.
Yeah you wouldn't
doing have that, you know, well. I remember at the time being like, what am I going to do? Like, the show got canceled. I'm never going to get hired. I couldn't get in another room. I didn't work for like 2 years. Like, all the money I'd saved from that show, I had like eaten up. I was broke when I met my husband. First of all, I don't know what the fuck he was thinking. I was 3 months sober and I had no money and no job. Part of like what Chris was just saying, I remember sitting there talking to my husband and going, I don't know how to do anything else.
Yeah.
I'm not going back to Ohio.
I lived there for 2 months.
And I just remember going, I don't know how to do anything else. So I guess I just keep doing this. And then it was still 5 years later that Freaky sold. But, like, I went in, like, thank God my boss at Family Guy and I got along, and she needed somebody for 2 weeks to run a desk. Ended up being there for 4 years again. So, like, I had a lifeline, thank God. And that's what I always tell people, that are in between writing gigs and, like, don't be afraid to go get, like, a real job. Because, the self-confidence I got from having a steady paycheck and being able to get sick and go to the doctor was pretty wonderful.
Yeah.
But I still laugh being like, Chris Landon used to come to the Family Guy office and sit in my fucking cube and write 5 pages over an hour of my lunch. It's like how we were writing Freaky at times and stuff.
Wow.
So I don't know. Like, in my own little way, I guess it's me like saying, yeah, like don't give up because like you never know what's gonna happen. You never know what's around the corner. It's like crazy like to think I was working a full-time job. I literally took a sabbatical from Family Guy to go to the fucking Freaky set. And then I sold a pitch on set at Freaky. And I called my boss and gave my 2 weeks. They literally were like, you can take 3 weeks to go to the shoot. They were so supportive.
That's great.
And during those 3 weeks, my deal closed for this next movie. So I called my boss. And I remember everyone on the set was like, you got to call her. You got to call her. Don't wait till you get back. Do it now. Do it now. And so I called her and she picked up the phone. She goes, you're quitting, aren't you?
She knew.
And she goes, I'm so sad for me, but I'm so happy for you. I loved working for her. I was a very good worker. Like, she didn't have to worry about this department. I ran the IT department.
Oh, really?
Okay.
But you know what I did? I went back and did my 2 weeks.
Good.
Mid-Freaky shoot. Did my 2 weeks of Family Guy and then came back for the last 2 weeks of the shoot.
That's great.
And this wonderful guy was sending me pictures.
Oh, from set?
Being like, you're missing this today. I thought you'd want to see this. Yeah. Or there would even be a day where he'd be like, I wish you were here today.
I know. Oh. I need the moral support. I think has that story. I got lucky very early in my career and got like my first writing job when I was still in college.
Wow.
I was 19. And it was a fluke. And then suddenly I got like, I had an agent and I was like this 20-year-old kid with like an agent and I got all these jobs and I botched all of them and burned my career to the ground in a very short period of time. But I also just came to the conclusion that I was like, I'm actually not cut out for this. Oh,
really?
I'm not good enough for this.
And you moved to Austin.
And I moved. I moved to Texas. I gave up my career.
Not Texas.
I got dropped by my agent. Austin, okay. Texas. It's different. But I moved to Austin and I was starting to study to get my real estate license.
Shut up.
Because I was like, I'm personable. I can sell houses. I can do this. But I didn't know anyone, and I was so lonely and in a very deep depression. And I wrote a TV pilot, which I had never done before, because I had this idea, and I sent it to a producer that I knew, and I asked her to read it just to get feedback. I remember in the email, I was like, I don't know if I even know how to do this anymore, but could you just read this for me and tell me if it's awful? Those were my words.
Wow. Sounds like you.
And then I sent it to her, and then like, she was like, yeah, sure, great. And then I didn't hear from her for like several weeks. And so I was like, oh, fuck, it's so bad. This must be so bad. And then she called me out of the blue. She's like, I'm so sorry that it took me so long to get back to you, but I sold it.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And I go, what? She goes, yeah, I sold it. They love it. CBS wants to buy it.
Oh my God.
And so I was like, what the fuck? And I flew back to LA and worked on this pilot that got shot. And
hour long?
Hour long. And they changed it in so many ways that it was unrecognizable, and they never made it. But while I was going through that process, I had in my spare time, I wrote a spec which called Disturbia.
No kidding.
Really?
And so, but here's the best part. And this is the icing on the cake, which is I went from someone who had given up completely. I did not believe in myself at all. I thought I was a total failure. And I was depressed and heartbroken. And then many, 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 many years later, I was standing on a stage at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas, getting to tell the story about how I wrote that pilot there and how the city and its energy also did save me. Because it was such a film-loving community that it inspired me to start writing again.
Was this premiere?
At the premiere at South by Southwest.
So cool. Oh, my God.
And so
God.
It was such a cool... And I was overcome with emotion thinking about it, not on that stage because I was too nervous and I thought I was going to throw up. But when I got there, it really hit me that I was like,
wow,
I thought I'd never get to do this. And I'm now at South by with my own movie. And it was pretty cool.
So cool.
Isn't it?
So that's...
You never know.
And you looked great. Those photos were wonderful.
That's the important thing. And
but it's just a reminder that like, you're just going to get fucking beat down.
Yeah.
Things take sometimes. Like
in ways that you never imagined.
Take a long time.
Yeah.
Too. Like,
I think the time thing is what I'm starting to learn.
It's not. We're all so conditioned. We're all such an immediate culture.
Yes.
I mean, we're the Amazon culture.
Right? I know.
And so we think everything is overnight.
Everything's
two-day delivery. And I believed it more than anyone in the beginning because I was fucking 19.
And you had all this success at first.
And it happened. And I was like, this is how it happens.
This is how we get made.
And then the universe was like, no, it isn't.
Take it away, bitch.
Sit down.
And sit down. Have a big seat.
It's when I tell that long nap. Some people misconstrue it and go, wow, like success happened so fast for you. I was like, I lived here 10 years before that.
It's not overnight.
It's not overnight.
Freaky came about quick.
Right.
In the sense that like...
And it's as its own thing.
As its own thing. But it took 10 years of learning. And
it's a process.
Unlearning. Yeah. And
wow.
Having confidence. And I still don't have confidence. Like, I'm still learning that.
I feel like a lot of artists don't, though. The more I talk to people and really get to know them.
Imposter syndrome. But this new current administration should tell you that that's not real.
Yeah. But also, like, you also, apart from the not being an overnight success, you also have to grow... accustomed to and somehow manage the impossible, which is build enough of a thick skin so that you don't give up, but also keep yourself vulnerable and open emotionally so that you can keep doing the work properly, because Hollywood will give it to you and take it away and give it to you and take it away your whole career.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the other reality that
I
live with.
Still one of the ways I make decisions.
Is it?
Does my like heart flutter when I think about a project?
Yeah.
If it doesn't, I'm always like...
So everything does kind of unfold as it's supposed to, even when it seems like it's
really hard to believe that.
Chris actually has had that philosophy, and I've learned that from him since I met him. Is like, I remember talking about casting. I was like, oh, that's a bummer. He always, to this day, will be, oh, I guess they just weren't supposed to be in the movie. Like, yeah. It's such a great way to look at things.
Looks like you just said about the journey being more important than the...
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
That's kind of the same thing, really.
Yeah.
Sure.
I'm so grateful that you guys just shared all of that because aww. I've had a really tough time on my future. Like, and I've questioned if I'm good enough to be here, if I'm strong enough to be here.
I think this is hard for a lot of people, but vulnerability is a huge thing. And just the fact that you're being vulnerable this way right now tells me you're going to get past this moment
and
keep building to what you are. I mean, I just think there's something about being vulnerable that shows a strength.
It is strength.
And without that strength, you won't get past this moment, and you clearly will.
Oh my God. Thanks, guys.
You've already gotten past it. You just don't know it.
That's what he keeps saying.
But that's also the other thing too, is that like the pain is part of the journey.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
It didn't feel painful. You don't love it.
That's true.
The pain is reminding you that you love it.
And know that like, it's just the beginning.
Oh, but you're also I'm like, can I do this for 20 years?
Absolutely.
Yeah, because it won't always be like that.
That's so true.
It's not possible for it to always be like that. But what you, the only thing you should do is take all the valuable shit you learned and bring it with you. And leave all the other shit behind.